One of the guys that I met was with J.P. Morgan. He invited me to lunch and he said, "We got the perfect job for you." He said, "We want to enlarge our operation in London." And so I became the executive director of J.P. Morgan Investment Management in London.
Greetings. Welcome to the Voices at the Point podcast. This voice you hear is Michelle Azinger. I have answered phone calls, given wake-up calls, and listened to countless and amazing stories from the one in a million voices at the Point. So I will introduce you to one today. We're speaking with Roger Dubois. Uh-huh. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Wonderful. I'd just like to talk to you today, get a little bit about your past life. We've talked quite a bit before we started recording, so you've got quite a few stories to tell. So can you tell me, let's start with, where did you grow up? Have you always been in the area?
No, I was born here in Pittsburgh, and my parents were living nearby, my mother in Bridgeville and my father in South Fayette, the area called Morgan. And so, I was born here, and after they married, they moved a little further west to a small town called Avella. In Washington County. And at the time they moved there, that would have been in, maybe 30. No, I was already born, so it had to be after that. Okay, early 30s. In the late 20s, in the booming 20s, that town was a boom town. And it had commuter trains going into the city. It had a railroad going through, obviously, but importantly, that railroad connected to the Ohio River, going down toward Wheeling and Weirton, and it connected here into Pittsburgh. And they had a large coal washer built. And so they serviced 14 mines in the area. So it was sort of a boom town.
Wow.
A couple hotels, a couple movie theaters, a couple dry cleaners, a couple tailors, everything. Whatever the service was, it was duplicated because they have competition. Somebody would say, it's a way to make money, I'll compete with them. So at any rate, they moved there. And I lived there through high school, and then I went to college in West Virginia. And after that was over, I was about 21, I went into the Navy. And that was it. And I never got back to Avella. My parents moved up to Willoughby, Ohio at the time I graduated from college and my sister graduated from high school. And she started nursing school up there at Case. And so I never got back. But many years later, maybe 40 years or so, 50 years later, I came back for a reunion. And some friends told me, gee, I should give Charlotte a call because she had been a widow for some 10 years or so, no, 4 or 5 years at that time. She had maybe spent 10 years caring for her husband. And so I did. And I had dated Charlotte while I was in high school. And she was from Burgettstown in high school. We played football against. And never beat while I played. And so we got together.
Wow.
And that was maybe 20 years ago now. And we lived nearby here in Hickory Heights. We moved into Hickory Heights and spent the winters in Florida, going back and forth. Usually go down right after the first of the year and come back, I don't know, after 3 months typically in Florida. And then a couple of weeks coming up the coast. And so we take a week going down and maybe 2 weeks coming back.
Was it just a drive without actually a plan? I mean, did you just...
The trips to Florida?
The trips, yes.
We decided that, I guess we decided against buying a place. And so we wanted to see both coasts. And so we spent a lot of time both in the northern part of Naples and the southern part. Marco and that kind of thing, but we also spent time on the ocean side. A couple three seasons there.
Uh-huh. Very nice.
But that became difficult after a while, going back and forth. Even though it, I mean, It was sort of almost embarrassing when we would tell people we were driving to Florida, and they say, gee, do you do it overnight or 2 days? And we said, well, how about, you know, 3 or 4 days?
And, a week, whatever it takes.
And typically we would arrive in Florida on one day and just, instead of going to wherever it was we were going to be living for the next 3 months, and we would just stop, stay in a hotel or motel, collect our thoughts, and then check in the morning and that kind of thing. Charlotte was Charlotte was a very fine golfer, a very good golfer, as a matter of fact. And I had never played golf until I met her, so that was a whole new world for me to take all that time to play golf. But it became more difficult toward the end. And so once, you know, the golf wasn't part of the trip, then the trip wasn't nearly as interesting or as attractive, quite honestly. And so how did we get here, though? The two of us, we started thinking about it because the house in Hickory Heights was too large, much too large for us. Like most homes in the area, there's always a hill involved somehow.
In Pittsburgh. It's really
flat. The big thing about our home in Hickory Heights, they kept telling us when we selected it, was it has a level backyard. That was the only level place for miles around. And so, it was the kind where, with three floors, you drove into the garage, ground level, and family room, and that kind of thing. But, and then to the kitchen, dining room, all that kind of stuff. And then bedrooms above it, and above that, an attic. And so, heaven forbid that you would be in the attic and be working on something, even changing a light bulb or some damn thing, and say, I need a tool.
And then you've got to go all the way down three more
four flights of stairs to go. So I was sympathetic to that idea. Another factor was I had a cousin, good friend of mine. We were good friends. I was good friends with this cousin living here, and she had moved into what's over on the other side of town?
Longwood?
No, on the other side, going
Friendship Village.
Friendship Village, and she. She sort of liked it, I think, and so I would visit her at Friendship Village, and I sort of liked the idea that there was a golf course down off the road, and in meeting her, I don't know, when we decided we should look at a place and think about doing this, I started visiting with Ann. It went pretty well, but there were some things we disliked about the place, too. No garage, no swimming pool, that kind of thing. And later, my financial advisor said, gee, you ought to take a look at Providence Point before you make up your mind. And lo and behold, when I came to Providence Point, Anne was here now.
She worked her charm.
And so I don't know, I don't know if I was her first first customer or not. I may have been. It would have been one of her early ones, if not the first closing. If it wasn't the first closing, it would have been one of her early ones. Yeah, and so we ended up being here.
Certainly glad that you chose.
I'm glad. I'm certainly, both of us are glad we chose it, yeah. And it is for that, the climate and the culture that's created here, this helpful one, the one where you just know you're making friends, and those friends are here for you, and the variety of activities, and that sense that as your health deteriorates and you need more and more aid and help, it's here. My career is I went to a small university, but still small, in West Virginia, close to the Pennsylvania line, named West Liberty University, a couple of miles away from Bethany, a couple of miles away from Ogilvie, out the hills. And the reason for that was very simple. It was the only school I could afford other than a Pennsylvania State Teachers College. And I wasn't particularly keen about being a public school teacher at that moment. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I wasn't sure about that. At any rate, I did go there. The Korean War was on. And so this is at the post-war period, post-World War II period. The Korean War was still going on. Early in my junior year, somewhere around there, they began giving you an opportunity to take it. You took a test, a standard test. And if you scored, I don't know, some score, if you scored, I don't know, maybe 75 or something, hey, you were eligible for a deferment. And if you scored, I don't know, 85 or 95, hey, you're not only eligible for a deferment for your undergraduate work, but you could pursue your education, whatever, professional school or graduate school. Hey, and so I took that test and scored reasonably well on it. In my junior year, the end of my junior year, early in my senior year, they began recruiting people to go into the service. Mm-hmm. And I had discussions with my father and a lot of friends, you know, this idea of staying in school because you can pass a test. Might not sound so good when you begin telling your children about it 10 or 15 or 20 years from now. And you got to think about what you were doing at that time. And I was tired of being poor, too. That's the other part of it. You get tired of being poor. And so, I decided, as I said, they were recruiting at the school at that time. A Marine lieutenant who went to the academy came by, and I said, well, I'm going to talk to this guy and see what it's all about. And so he knew what he was doing. He said, you're a nice guy and all that kind of stuff, but he said, I don't think you would ever make it in the Navy as an officer. And I said, what the hell are you talking about? I never make it. You don't know me.
So it's a challenge.
And he said, big deal, you got the schooling and you're going to graduate with cum laude and that kind of stuff. But it takes a lot more than that. And I thought, well, damn it. Yeah, you're right, I'll show him.
Just came on.
Yeah. And so I enlisted. I went on to officer school and I spent 3.5 years in the Navy. Most of it aboard a destroyer. In the Atlantic, then with the Sixth Fleet and the Mediterranean, and then tours in the Caribbean and that kind of thing, and then a short period in Norfolk on shore duty before I got out. When I did get out, then I decided to instead of going back to graduate school and studying history as I thought I was going to do as an undergraduate. Again, meeting different people and getting different ideas. This was the time to go to graduate school in business. And then the question came, well, where to go to graduate school in business? And it was clear at that time the two top-notch schools, the two best schools were Harvard and Wharton, the University of Pennsylvania. And I selected Wharton because I could go in the middle of the year. I got out of the Navy in November, and I could go to school in January. And so I was admitted to Wharton, and I tried to save money while I was in the Navy as an officer, but somehow I never saved very much. So I was so bad at saving, I would send $100 a month home to my father. And I can remember on one leave I came home, and he said, I can't afford your savings plan anymore. Because I would write him and I would send him $100 and 2 weeks later. And so he says, I'm sending you more money than you're sending me. And so I had a discussion with the people at Penn, and I told him, I said, look, I'm here and I think I've got enough money for one semester. I've got the GI Bill, but that isn't going to pay your tuition. And I'm going to need help, I think. And I said, well, show us what you can do. And so they gave me a fellowship. And so
wow.
I had a, So I had a Philco fellowship, and the beauty of that was not only did I have my tuition fees and that kind of thing paid, but I also had a summer job with Philco, and obviously an offer to go to work for them afterwards, which I did not do. But that was graduate school, and then from there to Ford Motor Company, and I was on the labor relations staff at Ford, the corporate labor relations staff, for about 7 years. I did a lot of work, the kind of work that your husband did on union matters, negotiating, and that was good. Those were good years. And you want me to tell you about the early experience?
Okay, the Ascot story.
Yeah, the year I went, well, to go there was a big deal because in those days, companies hadn't become accustomed to this idea that if you want to attract good students, you have to build a relationship with the university and with the placement office, and you've got to do it in good times and bad times. You know, and so they were very transactional in this process at that time. So the idea was, hey, you go to a school and recruit when you need people and times are good. When you don't need people and you're laying people off, you certainly don't go to school and recruit new graduates, you know, so that wasn't the way to conduct a business. Hey, and so the year I graduated, Ford Motor Company did not send anyone to recruit. But lo and behold, the controller from their Chester plant came by, and he said, I really need somebody in accounting. And so the placement director said, look, I know you don't want accounting and that, but why don't I just give you some practice, fill up his schedule. So I sat in with him, and I told him, look, I have no interest in accounting at all, hey, but I'm interested in Ford, and I'm interested in labor relations, and I'd like to really go to Ford to be a part of that. And he said, okay. So let me see what I can do. And so he wrote a letter to the vice president of labor relations, and they invited me out, and I was the only graduate they took that year.
Really?
Oh, wow.
That's amazing.
The whole company. Yeah. You ask about, early on then, maybe I was there a year, year and a half, I had an opportunity to make a presentation to the board of directors, and Henry Ford II was the chairman at the time, and my director took me in advance of the presentation. He thought it would be good if I had the opportunity to size up the room for the very first time, Jen. And so the room was not unlike this kind of room, board of directors meeting room, laid out pretty much as this is, tables all the way around. And it was heavily paneled, and paneled so much so with, I don't know, heavy board all the way around, dark mahogany finish all the way around. And he said, it's important that you become familiar with the room so you're comfortable making the presentation. And so we went through a kind of tour of it. And he said, now to get in and out is pretty easy because there's an exit sign above it. And he said, but the next most important door, though, he said, you have to know, is where the men's room is. And you look around, and all you can see is all this paneling. And so he showed me the secret way of getting into the men's room if I had to get into the men's room. And then I think I spent some time at the podium, and he said, this podium is wired in such a way that you don't worry about the microphones. It's all built in. And he said, you can hold on to it if you want to. You can put your hands in your pocket. You can look around, gesture any way you want to. Be as comfortable as you like. Just stay reasonably close to it. And so I turned it on, and that worked out pretty well. And then he said, now I got to show you some more about the room. And so he took me around, and he said, this room, though, the electronics are pretty advanced. He said, every seat in the board of directors room, the desk is set up with a microphone. It's mic'd. And he said, when the meeting starts, those microphones are turned on, and no one can say a word without all the other members of the board hearing it. And so there's no talking between two guys No plotting or scheming or anything. So there's just absolutely no talking. He said, unless Henry feels in a good mood and invites conversation, otherwise you don't say a word unless you're recognized by the chairman. Hey, and so I made the presentation, but it was... I think how he behaved that the day I was. I don't think it was in a particularly good mood, because I was telling most of what I had to say was in the form of bad news from his point of view. He had a very good public impression at that stage of being modern, up to date, favorably inclined toward unions. Wanted good relations, but in person, he wasn't too keen about unions, not unlike his grandfather and that kind of thing. And that image, like his marriages and that kind of thing, were well protected. I mean, when he was divorced from his first wife, that was the first notice of it in the Detroit papers. All the talk that had gone on in the months and maybe years before that point, there wasn't a word in the Detroit papers. But when he was divorced, that was announced.
Wow.
So he was accustomed to controlling things pretty tightly if he wanted to. Hey, but in that day, I think he was not in a particularly good mood, I think. And so I was telling him what was going on in the steel business, what was going on in the glass business, that kind of thing, what was going on with the can companies, what kind of wage increases were likely to be demanded, what kind of improvements were likely to be demanded in employee benefits. And I used the term trend. I don't know, it was in connection with some changes that were occurring employee benefits, I think in the pension area, quite honestly. He said, well, what evidence do you have that that's a trend? And I said, well, there are a couple agreements that have addressed it, and there's a lot of talk in the press about it, and it's about all I had. And I've talked to some other companies, and hey, they sort of are trying to get ready to, they're anticipating demands in this area. And he said, when I studied the trend, was an expression that was used that was always supported by hard data. Hard data over time. And he's thinking of X and Y axis, timeline along the bottom. And he said, that kind of current information doesn't constitute a trend. In so many words, he said that. And he was right. It was hardly a trend. It was something going on at the moment. It would have been like the skirts were shortened. It would have been no more than that, at the time for the next season. Hey, then I left Ford, and the reason I left Ford was a couple factors, but the most important one I think was. My wife at the time understood that I wasn't going there to spend the rest of my life. I was going there because I wanted to be a part of this labor relations staff and really get that kind of experience with a top-notch group. And then we would go wherever you wanted to go, wherever the opportunities were. And all I could think about, and I knew, that if I went anywhere with Ford, all I would do is want to work like hell to get back. I was already there. I was already on a corporate staff. Why would I leave and work like hell to get back to it? It didn't make any sense. The other point was at that time, it was becoming readily apparent that this I had hard data on now, our economy was shifting to the service side. And it had just crossed over that if we looked at the GNP, if we looked at employment, a little more than half of it was coming from the service side. And so sort of like the handwriting, and the Japanese, were starting to make automobiles for nothing compared to what we were charging. And this thing out of Germany, this Volkswagen, It was selling tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands here. And that was a lot different from these cars we were producing with the big fins and that kind of thing. And covering everything with chrome and whatever we were doing at the time. And so I thought it's a good time to make a change. I should go into the service sector, though, but rather than manufacturing. And if I go into the service sector, I could think about insurance, think about banking, you know, what might I do? And I decided I wanted I wanted an industry that I could that was large and had competition in it and was diversified in terms of location. One of the characteristics of one of the features of living in Detroit and working for one of the big three, you didn't leave Ford and go to work for General Motors, or Chrysler, or that. You didn't even think about it. You would never hire from a competitor.
Yeah.
So that was out of the question. And so I chose. I had an opportunity to go to Chase, and Chase was a major player at that time, and David Rockefeller had just become president, not chairman yet, but they were grooming him for that role, the competition among the large three banks was pretty much Chase and Citibank and maybe manufacturers and J.P. Morgan probably. Those were the large ones. And Citibank had a great lead, and a great lead they had was, part of it was the success of their retail side, but their international, they were very, very strong international. They were really the first massive American multinational bank. And so David Rockefeller thought, well, hey, that's my job. We just got to develop it in our international capabilities. And that sort of attracted me. And so one of the things that they wanted was small staff and human resources personnel, whatever they called it at that time. And they had one guy who had a lot of experience in labor relations. And he said, what we really should have is somebody skilled in labor relations to join us now so that when we begin doing this international expansion, we know what we're about. And so I was selected for that, and I joined them as second vice president or something
wow.
like that. And I became responsible for Western Europe and the Caribbean. And the guy that hired me looked after, he loved Japan. He looked after the Pacific and Japan. And so I did that for maybe a year or two. And I met a lot of people, and those were good years. That was my first opportunity, as I think I told you earlier, my first opportunity to fly overseas, and that was pretty exciting. I spent time in Europe, so I was in the Navy, and that was fun with the Sixth Fleet, but I had never flown across the Atlantic, and then it was my first time, but was in. My first opportunity to fly in a 747, that was sort of exciting. And then earlier you had asked, why do I wear a cravat from time to time? I remember in those days when you flew on a plane, if you flew for the bank, you flew first class. And when you flew first class, you dressed in a business suit and you boarded with your tie, and with your tie knotted and pulled closely. And I noticed one of those flights, if not the first one, there were some guys sitting very comfortably wearing open collars with cravats. And I thought, God, that looks so comfortable. I'm going to do that. And so I tried, and I told, I guess, my wife and my mother, I thought that was great.
Then your collection began.
My collection began, and then when I was in London later in life, a lot of opportunities to add to it. Liberty had a field day producing these silk cravats.
Yes.
And, you know, and others did too. But yeah. So where were we? God, we're going at this pace, you know, we'll be here all day. So we have to move along. I was there chased for about 10 years, roughly 10 years. And I left Chase to go to Bankers Trust. While I was at Chase, after the experience in labor relations, they asked me to take over a large operating unit, which I did, and a couple thousand people. And a lot of things were going on at that time. This was the time that automation in a real way was just starting. But the focus of it at that time was do away with paper and hopefully do more things with computers. But doing work with computers though meant using key punch cards. So you had armies of people key punching data, you know, and the cards would be run through machines, and the machines would produce tapes, and the tapes would go into the mainframe computers, and the computers that you had at your desk were not computers, were really terminals. It was that simple. And so how do you go about automating that and improving on it? That was one part. In the industry, in Manhattan, on the street, the big thing that was going on was how to get rid of all this paper. And so at that time, it was just about over, but it still occurred. And so if you wanted to sell securities from one firm to another, how do you do that? Well, the security, the stock, was a piece of paper, and it had to be documented and all that kind of thing to make it negotiable. But how do you get it from the seller to the buyer? They actually had used messengers. There's a whole army of messengers. People who, you know, a guy might, you know, late in the afternoon, he may be a conductor on the train, but in the morning he's a messenger in Wall Street, you know, that kind of thing. And so how to get rid of messengers. And so the answer was to do things in a book entry way. So you don't really need this physical certificate, we'll do it with, and then in an accounting fashion. And so at that time we began first with the government bonds, treasuries, getting rid of the certificates, and doing it all by computer, all the book entry method. And it revolutionized that business at that point in time. While I was there, I moved from that after doing a lot of, tell you one story. The unit I had started with 2,000 people. When I left it, I was down to about 700, and within 3 years, I think. And plans were underway for, another 150 or 200 to leave with automation. Automation wouldn't have that kind of impact.
Around what year? What are we?
Let's see, graduated 58. This would be the 70s.
The 70s.
Yeah, we were at Chase Plaza. Chase Plaza was built downtown. David Rockefeller and his brother was the governor, and so they sort of put things together and said, "Why don't we start redeveloping downtown?" And so Skidmore always was hired to design this beautiful, beautiful building, and they came up with the idea, or popularized the idea, that if you build public space, in their case, a plaza, big open space, instead of having the ice, you remember, the wedding cake kind of building, you could go straight up with it on all sides. And so they built this beautiful, beautiful building at Chase. And that began, Chase Plaza began the renaissance of really downtown for the first time. Maybe they're going to go through a second one now, but and it was very, very successful. Beautiful, beautiful building. And to go up, though, you had to go down, and if you might think about it, Manhattan, of course, is a great place to go down, the big rock, it's a big bunch of rocks, big rocks. And so they start going down, and went down 5 floors. So I had people working on 5 floors underground.
Underground.
So, yeah, so somebody who grew up around here with all the coal mines, hell, that was nothing, you know. And not only did 5 floors down, But subway trains and tracks, in some cases, were above you.
Were above, oh my gosh.
And so guys would sit in an office and they'd say, come sit here. And I said, well, why do you want me to sit here? Well, sit by the wall there.
Then you're going to hear it coming right over your head.
Yeah, or alongside of you, yeah, the tunnel would be. Hey, at any rate, I did the other thing I did. So with this large unit is I became one of the earlier people to begin working in this, the development of the master trust business. And it was a very important way of servicing large institutional investors. Investors, pension funds investing money, but nonprofits investing money. A few wealthy individuals only a few, and they were typically international Greek shipping guys that could make use of that kind of service. But I wanted to stay with it. And the big thing that was system side was very important. And I had developed a very good team in systems. And so I had this opportunity to go with Bankers Trust, which was a major bank in that area at the time, and spent about 10 years with them, primarily in this master trust business. I first was asked to come in as work with a consultant and go through three or four of the businesses. And when we did and straightened them out, they asked me to choose which one I wanted, and I chose to run the master trust business, and I did with them. And the big change that occurred in those days, in that period, and into the 90s, was the investing overseas, international investing, multi-currency accounting. And at that time, when you talk to an American about multi-currency accounting, that meant whatever the foreign currency was, you expressed it in dollars. I mean, that was as simple as that. You know, nobody would think in terms of saying, how many francs is the Deutsche Mark worth? Who would even want to know that?
Right. Why does it matter?
Forget about yen and anything else. You know? And so, and they sold these multi-currency investments. They tell them, well, you have a chance to make money not only on the rise of the value of the stock in its local market, but you also have a chance to make money on the currency against the dollar. And nobody bothered telling them that you could go the other way and lose money also on that movement of the currency. But at any rate, that was sort of the lay of the land at that time. And that just fascinated me because that was, again, getting me back to Europe and spending a lot of time in Europe. And that tied in with all of my studies as an undergraduate in history, European history, and my family. My four grandparents are all buried here in Bridgeville, but they all were born overseas, that kind of thing. And so I felt very comfortable doing it. And I think we did very, very well with it. And Bankers Trust did very well in that business. And it was a chance to start some other smaller businesses that were very, very profitable, lending securities that belong to other people, lending them to the street, investing short-term funds, stiff funds, they're called short-term investment funds, very, very profitable for that kind of operation, because you didn't take the cash from one account or two accounts, you took the cash that was, you made that available to the cash that was available in thousands of accounts. And so instead of buying a couple $100,000 or $1 million worth, you were looking at literally billions of dollars to be invested. And if you're investing short term and you have a fund, you only care about the net. you don't worry about investing all of it. It's only the difference. Are you going to sell or are you going to buy at the end of the day?
Right.
And so it was a relative, but on the other hand, in the meantime, whatever you had in the fund was earning interest, and you were sharing that with the customer who owned the securities, and so it was a very good business. Hey, at any rate, after that, I, and of course, doing that too, I began meeting a lot of people, not a lot, but other people. And one of the guys that I met was with J.P. Morgan. He invited me to lunch, and he wanted me to tell him about international investing and how you go about servicing it from a client point of view, reporting, analyzing the results, doing performance measurement, supporting portfolio managers that want to invest in that, want to manage portfolios in that area. Hey, and so I don't know. We had a couple of meetings, got to know, and then I don't know, somewhere a couple of years later, we got together, and I said, I really would like to, go overseas and work. And he said, my God, he said, why don't you tell me that? And so we put a deal together for me in 1 week, and came back, and he said, we got the perfect job for you. He said, we want to enlarge our operation in London. We're creating a wholly owned subsidiary there. It'll be for international investing. They had already broken the ground under ERISA and found out that pension plans here could invest overseas. And he said, the perfect job for you. He said, I got a young guy, relatively young, that's a fantastic portfolio manager. He has good personal skills. He doesn't know anything about running a business. Go. And so I became the executive director of J.P. Morgan Investment Management in London.
Wow.
And
I'm just going to pack up and move to London.
It was almost just like that. And so, in fact, I think he made the offer. I accepted the offer, whatever it was. And then I thought, well, and I gave the people at Bankers, I don't know, a couple weeks' notice, a month's notice, a month probably. And then I went to Morgan on a Monday morning. I went to this area where he worked, and he had his office, and he invited me to the Monday morning. I guess it was a Monday morning. He invited me to the Monday morning meeting, and we sit around, and everybody talks about what's going on in the markets all over the world, this kind of thing. Hey, and then afterwards, he says, "Come on back." He said, "Let's go back and visit for a while." And so we did. When I sat down, he says, "What the hell are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, it's my first day." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "You don't want to waste your time here." I said, "What do you mean waste my time?" He said, "Look, go home and enjoy your family for this week. And as quickly as you can make arrangements, whatever time it takes, go to London." And so at that time, I had all, in the meantime, I had moved. I was on a farm. In Far Hills, I moved from Basking Ridge to Far Hills, a couple miles away, and this farm, and I've been, getting it all ready to sell, and we did that, and flew off to London, and spent 10 years or so there, and then a little bit of time in Japan, and came back here. But the time in London was a great time.
Wow.
London had changed. London, before that, was, if you went to Europe, I said, "God, do I really have to go to London? There's not a decent restaurant in the whole damn city. The beer is warm.
It's warm.
And it just a lot of reasons not to go." By the time the 90s came, London was a swinging town. All the ethnic groups were there. All the nationalities were there. You could find fine Italian restaurants, not lousy Italian restaurants, fine Italian restaurants. I don't think British food improved, but British food was always and remained lousy.
So you're not a fish and chips fan?
With vinegar on top of the chips. I lived right in the center city, so right off of Hyde Park, and it was very, very nice, yeah. No, I loved London.
Wonderful.
The train had started too. So you could go, you could take the fast train to Paris, which was sort of nice. Get up in the morning and get on a train and have lunch in Paris and have a meeting up there. And it's really lovely. Hey, but that, I worked, as I said, a little over 10 years. And, I reached the point where I was the oldest guy. I may have been the oldest senior officer at J.P. Morgan, but I was certainly the oldest one in the investment management side. And I thought, good grief, I should keep doing this. This is crazy. And so they had some trouble in Japan, and I said, why don't I go help that guy out? And we'll do this transition for me in London, and then I'll call it quits. And I said, how long will you stay? And I said, no, 1 year. I'll just, and if I can't do it 1 year, get someone else. And so that was the deal. And I went to Japan for a year. Hey, I'm not sure, well, I'll tell you my solution to the problems of that office in Japan. It was not making money, it was losing money. And I was there, and there were three or four other guys at about the same, almost the same level, Americans. And if you know anything about Tokyo, if you're going to have an American live in a home, an apartment, a place like he's accustomed to living in, it's going to cost a fortune. I mean, not a little fortune, a big fortune. They paid more for my place on a monthly basis than I paid on a yearly basis.
Oh, wow.
Unbelievable. And so it was so high, it didn't even bother going through me. It just said, look, don't even bother. Don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. It was just so outrageous. And so my solution to their problems was send all these Americans back because they're not doing a damn thing. And that's, that's what they did. Because they were there, holding hands with Japanese people, trying to teach them to invest as an American would, that kind of thing. And maybe learn something about the Japanese market, that kind of thing. But it was just overburdened with that kind of costly work. Did not have the business or the revenue to support it, which wasn't a very good business plan, but at least it gave them out of losing money.
There you go.
And solved that problem. And came back and then retired. Because, I didn't want to, because I thought I was too old for that business. And also I didn't want to start another serious relationship and build up another management team. My experience was always, it took me a couple, 3 years to, if it's something new, maybe it takes you a year to learn what it's about, and then you need another year for developing plans and building a management team, and then another year to start implementing it successfully before you feel pretty good about leaving. And so it's at least 3 years, 4 years, and I didn't want that. So. But I did some consulting for a short time after I left. That was short-lived because people wouldn't listen to me.
Because you were too old. They're not listening to you anymore, old man.
And then came out. And then, as I told you, I start renewing friendships here. I'd visit with my family in Willoughby, in Ohio. And I never lived in Ohio, so I had a few friends from Pennsylvania there, but I would come back here and visit a few friends. And that's when I learned about Charlotte and
Wonderful. Well, we're so glad you did.
Yep. Well, I'm not gone yet. Don't say that.
I didn't mean it that way. Well, I just meant,
I still have a lot of opportunity to screw things up yet.
Thank you for listening to the Voices at the Point podcast. If you'd like to learn more about Providence Point, please visit us at www.providencepoint.org and follow us on Facebook at Baptist Senior Providence Point and Instagram at Baptist_Senior_Providence.